DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Just put your paws up, 'cause you were born this way, baby.
This week on Living Planet, we're going to meet climate warriors, fearless female farmers, and Antarctic ice smashers. I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to this special edition of Living Planet for International Women's Day. We're starting out this week remembering the life of Wangari Maathai. She was a Kenyan environmentalist born in 1940 in the foothills of Mount Kenya. She was the first woman to earn a doctorate in veterinary anatomy in East and Central Africa. Around this time, Kenya's forests were being torn down for fuel wood and for building materials, and men were leaving the rural areas to go and work in the cities. The women, left behind to work the land, reported that the streams were drying up, the food supply was vanishing, and there was no more firewood. Well, Wangari Maathai had an idea. She encouraged Kenyan women to work together to grow seedlings and plant trees. The idea is that this would bind the soil, store rainwater, and provide food and firewood. Her Green Belt movement has planted more than 30 million trees in Africa and helped nearly 900,000 women. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004, and we have a clip of her acceptance speech.
As the first African woman to receive this prize, I accept it on behalf of the people of Kenya and Africa, and indeed the whole world. Tree planting became a natural choice to address some of the initial basic needs identified by women. Also, tree planting is simple, attainable, and guarantees quick, successful results within a reasonable amount of time. These are all important to sustain interest and commitment. So together we planted over 30 million trees that provide fuel, food, shelter, and income to support the children's and education and household needs. The activity also creates employment and improves soils and watersheds. Through their involvement, women gain some degree of power over their lives, especially their social and economic position and relevance in the family.
Wangari Maathai died in 2011 at the age of 71, but her legacy lives on in the replenished forests of Kenya. We're traveling now to one of the harshest regions on Earth, Antarctica. Now, the history of women in Antarctica before 1969 is brief but colorful. It's believed Carolyn Mikkelsen, the wife of a Norwegian whaling captain, was the first woman to set foot on the continent. She was followed by a handful of women married to explorers, scientists, and military personnel. But there was an actual ban in place preventing most women from traveling there. For environmental researchers, this meant they were dependent on their male colleagues to send back data, which they analyzed at home. But in recent decades, women have been smashing through the ice around Antarctica. We're about to meet a marine ecologist and climate expert. Her name is Corina Broussard, and she is part of a new generation of women climate scientists who are carving out a place for themselves on the ice flats once considered the sole territory of men.
The Royal Netherlands Institute for Sea Research is located on the Wadden Island of Texel. It takes half an hour to travel on the ferry from the Dutch mainland. The wind is icy cold and seagulls fly overhead. As the ferry approaches the shore, Royal Netherlands Institute comes into sight. This is where Corina Broussard works. She is a senior scientist in marine viral ecology. Broussard points at a large ship docked in the harbor, the Pelagia, a large, sleek research vessel.
In 10 days, I'm going to cruise again with this ship to the North Sea.
Broussard has just been made an affiliate professor in viral ecology at the University of Amsterdam. She is the first woman to receive this title in her field of science. It's no small accomplishment. Broussard has encountered considerable opposition as she pushed her way into climate science, once considered a male stronghold in scientific circles. She remembers encounters with some of the other researchers when she began her PhD.
I just said, for example, like, I'm not really sure about this. What do you think? And my male colleagues, because I was the only female student, they were like, you're insecure. And I was like, no, I'm sharing thoughts. What do you mean I'm insecure? I'm not insecure. Yes, you're insecure. You know, I want to share thoughts and I want to see where ideas go. I've been called a bitch. Why is it negative when a woman is assertive?
Clashes in the lab didn't discourage Brussard. In fact, she set her sights on one of the harshest environments in the world. Brussard leads a team that is investigating the role of viruses in polar marine ecosystems in Antarctica. She is based in the Netherlands, but she also does research in Antarctica's fierce, icy waters. As Brussard describes the brutal conditions, her eyes sparkle. She loves the challenge. Brussard's team monitors algae development in water columns. When glaciers melt and the water temperature rises, this changes the development of algae. Since algae forms the base of aquatic food webs, changes in composition could have an impact on other life forms in the ecosystem.
So it starts with these algae, and if we find other types of algae, especially in this case smaller algae, it means that that affects right away the food chain. And so how many fish we end up with, or how many whales or orcas.
Brussard is one of a handful of women leading this kind of work in Antarctica, where the ratio of men to women is about 10 to 1.
If you get pregnant, you're off. It's the first thing they tell you when you go get all your trainings. Don't get pregnant, you're gone. Because they can't facilitate the medical need, even if something goes wrong.
The conditions can be particularly difficult in the winter, when field teams live in tents. Sometimes teams are made up of just two people. Field trip coordinators often assume it would be harder for men and women to share the tent.
And the weather is bad and you're stuck in the tent for like a week or 2 weeks. You should not have too many personal barriers. I mean, you need to get, you know, you need to pee.
But in recent decades, women have stepped into research programs in Antarctica. An all-woman research crew set the pace when they arrived in Antarctica in the late 60s to study salty lakes fed by freshwater glaciers in Antarctica's dry valleys. Now, women are being actively encouraged to participate in Antarctica research. The Australian Antarctic Division even has a recruitment program for women. Brussard's team includes women researchers. Some have come to see her as a role model and a pioneer. Labels that she's reluctant to wear.
I never saw myself as a pioneer, but I realized when I was approached by female students that I am actually one of the pioneers in our viral ecology, marine viral ecology world. As some of these students say, like, you know, so it's possible.
As we finish the tour of Brussard's labs at the Royal Netherlands Institute for Sea Research, she says it's nice to be noticed as a female role model. But what she's really interested in is science. Especially the ocean.
71% on the surface of the globe is water, seawater. It's amazing that we go and spend so much money out in outer space, which is perfect, but we spend hardly any of that into the deep ocean or the surface ocean.
Laura Postma for DW in Texel, Netherlands.
We leave behind our Antarctic explorer now and travel out to the dry farms of rural Mexico. Women run 60% of Mexico's farms, which means they are on the front lines as drought ravages their fields. DW correspondent Ophelia Harms traveled into the Mexican countryside and has this report.
Apolonia Alvarez is walking to her cornfields near the town of Izúcar de Matamoros in the Mexican state of Puebla. The 54-year-old farmer is small in build, but she bounds ahead with a powerful stride. Alvarez opens the gate to a small corn patch, about 60 square meters in size. It's in a sorry state. The earth is dusty and bare, and most of the stalks lie dying in the hot midday sun.
It almost didn't grow this time. The rain stopped when the crops were still very, very small.
The mother of four tries to support her family with what she grows here, but has only been able to harvest a couple of sacks of corn over the past year. When the crop fails, Alvarez supplements her income by doing small jobs for other people.
I'm here by myself. When I can, I sometimes help to wash or iron other people's clothes. But I don't get very much, 40, sometimes 50 pesos every now and then.
That's around €3 or a little on the $4. Alvarez used to live in the state of Guerrero, but she and her family left when gun-carrying gangs made it too dangerous to stay. Her husband went to the U.S., where he now has a construction job. Many rural men are moving to the cities in search of work, but violence isn't the only reason they're leaving.
Today, as I sign the North American Free Trade Agreement into law...
When Mexico signed onto NAFTA, an agreement eliminating trade barriers with the U.S. and Canada, cheap agricultural imports flooded the market. Domestic farms simply couldn't compete, and the men were forced to look for work elsewhere. The women have been left behind to care for the farms. According to the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization, more than 60% of Mexico's farms are now run by women. At the Agricultural Ministry in Puebla State Capital, farmers in huge hats and cowboy boots wander in to take part in meetings. All of them are men. Antonio Espejel Claudio is in charge of programs for the region's poorest farmers. He acknowledges that there has been a demographic shift across the state of Puebla.
For example, in the region of Mixteca, we work almost exclusively with women because many men have migrated to the U.S.
Puebla's agricultural ministry is distributing subsidies to improve irrigation systems and upgrade farm machinery. Officials here consider women farmers a good investment because they tend to pass the benefits of subsidies onto their children and other family members.
In most of our projects, we detected much more participation from women. They seem to be more responsible than the men.
The women are also getting training in land management and financial planning, skills that will be crucial as Mexico's weather becomes more unpredictable. Meteorologist Yubia Gomez-Texon studies weather patterns in this part of Mexico and says that the drought here is likely to continue.
In regions like the Mixteca or Azúcar de Matamoros, which are much warmer, we can expect up to 35 degrees. These are the sort of temperatures that have been registered in previous years, and we are expecting the same again this spring.
That creates a new challenge for women farmers like Apolonia Alvarez, who is struggling to cultivate her dry corn fields in Azúcar de Matamoros. She says she's never seen a drought this bad. She also hasn't heard about the subsidies for female farmers. Communication in the rural areas of Puebla State is almost non-existent. Another challenge for the officials here, as they try to improve the lives of women farmers.
Thank you to Ophelia Harms for that report from the dusty fields of Mexico. We're returning to Europe now, and we're going on a road trip to a coal-fired plant responsible for some of the worst air pollution in Europe. And while we're on the road, we're going to meet Jette Jara. She's an outspoken, controversial critic of Kosovo's coal industry. Nate Tabak has more.
Oh my God, I wish she had a camera. Look at this.
35-year-old Jette Jara is driving her minivan on a road just outside Kosovo's capital, Pristina. About a kilometer off the road, to the left, smoke billows from a sprawling industrial complex.
This is just exactly for your as if turned on full blast smokestacks working for you today, Nate.
What are we looking at exactly?
We're looking at the Kosovo power plants, coal power plants, smokestacks, full of pollution and smoke coming out.
I've known Jette for some time now from our work together at the Balkan Investigative Reporting Network. She's perhaps the most famous journalist in Kosovo. She's made a name for herself, fearlessly taking on corrupt politicians. These days, though, she's facing another challenge, lignite, better known as brown coal. Kosovo has the world's fifth-largest lignite reserve, with 14 billion metric tons. The lignite feeds a cluster of power plants that supply more than 95% of Kosovo's electricity. Initially, the power plants represented progress, but to Jette, they symbolize one of Kosovo's biggest problems, air pollution. Yetta's two-month-old daughter, Hannah, is sleeping in a car seat. Yetta doesn't want to expose her to even more lignite emissions, so we turn around. Back at Yetta's apartment in Pristina, Hannah is stirring. Lately, Yetta has been thinking a lot more about the future of her kids. In addition to little Hannah, Yetta has a two-year-old daughter. There's a lot to worry about here in Kosovo as a parent. The education system is struggling, basic services like running water are unreliable, and unemployment is around 45%. But it's the environment that bothers Yetta the most.
What makes me completely angry and helpless as a parent to know that no matter what I do and how good I am as a mother, just putting my children through living here will itself make them sick. So I really hate feeling helpless.
The government hopes to shut down the worst offending power plant, Kosovo A, by 2017. But they plan on replacing it with a new coal plant, Kosovo C. It's something that Yetta isn't happy about.
I don't want to leave my kids a legacy of a coal power plant.
So Yetta has fought back by designing an advertising campaign, criticizing the plan.
The World Bank says that in 2010, air pollution caused 835 premature deaths.
This TV advertisement, along with two others like it, shows a baby stroller in different parts of Kosovo. The baby is apparently sickened by the air.
So why are we planning to build yet another pollution source?
It's definitely sensational, and the centerpiece of a new campaign against the new power plant. The basic premise: Kosovo should pursue green energy and energy efficiency instead of building more coal plants. Yetta is pleased with the effect it's having.
The ad has created a debate and has pissed off people as well as has shocked people.
The campaign marks Yetta's transformation into an unapologetic environmental activist. As a journalist, she's frequently highlighted the power plant issue on her weekly TV show. But the ad campaign is new territory. Yetta says she has no problems with slipping into the role of activist. She entered journalism in the late 1990s to turn the world against the late Serbian president Slobodan Milosevic and its brutal crackdown on Albanians in Kosovo. Lumir Abdajiku runs the Reinvest think tank in Pristina. Abdajiku agrees that Kosovo needs more green energy, but says Yetta's vision isn't realistic. He doesn't think it's possible to close the old Kosovo A plant and cover the deficit with renewables and energy efficiency quickly enough. And he also dismissed that new ad campaign with the coughing baby as a scare tactic.
It was kind of Hitchcockian approach to scare the Kosovars that, well, if we build another power plant, everyone is going to die very soon, and which is not realistic at all. I mean, I would rather concentrate on quite cleaner power plants based on coal rather than saying, no, we don't need this coal.
Abdajiku says Yetta has given the anti-coal campaign a lot of credibility, but he thinks it'll be short-lived. Yetta, though, is digging in for a long fight to stop the new coal plant.
I'm a journalist. I'm prepared to make lots of noise and put lots of questions and make lots of decision makers sweat before they make the decision, and I'm prepared to hold them to their legacy.
But with the government set on the new coal plant, with the support of the World Bank, Yetta acknowledges stopping Kosovo C will be an uphill battle. Still, she says she's already made a key victory, making the power plant a mainstream issue. Nate Tabak, DW, Pristina, Kosovo.
Our last report on this special Women's Day edition of Living Planet takes us to Japan. On March 11, 2011, an earthquake and tsunami knocked out cooling systems at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Radioactive isotopes were blown out over Japan and the surrounding coastal waters. Farmlands near the power plant, once rich and fertile, were contaminated. But we're about to meet a farmer who has decided to stay on the land. DW correspondent Danny Mitzman brings us this report about Yuko Sudo, a farmer who is trying to revive the local organics movement in Japan's nuclear landscape.
で、それを見て育った
った環境で
My aunt was an apple grower and she inspired me to become a farmer and gave me my passion for agriculture. That's how I started.
いました。はい。
For 8 years, Yoko Sudo worked hard to build her highly successful organic farming business just outside the city of Fukushima. Before the disaster, she grew 40 different plant species.
I used to grow all kinds of produce, lettuces, legumes and root vegetables. I would package them myself and distribute them directly to families and restaurants. I had a great reputation for the quality of my produce. My clients would say, "This is excellent." They admired me. I made a name for myself.
A young, independent female farmer, Yoko Sudo owned just a single field and rented a second one. Her business method was simple. She took orders from her customers who would invest in their produce beforehand. She would then grow it and deliver it to them, thereby avoiding waste and satisfying her market.
So those who want to buy, give money beforehand for her to buy the seeds and the land. It's a very effective method.
That's Ishida Masayoshi, Vice President of Slow Food Japan. He remembers how Yoko Sudo's no-risk approach to farming made her a national role model.
Hers is a very sensible method, and it is a roaring success. She was given an award by the Ministry of Agriculture. She has become a celebrity in Japan.
But Yoko Sudo's utopian farm model was brought to a premature end on the 11th of March 2011.
A further explosion has rocked Japan's quake-damaged Fukushima nuclear power complex in the northeast of the country.
Yoko's land is just 60 kilometers from the Fukushima nuclear plant. She says she will never forget the days immediately following the disaster.
The state told us to stop distributing, but they didn't tell us to stop all agriculture, just to slow down. Personally, I stopped completely. I could have continued, but I was terrified of touching the soil. I completely stopped until a year later, when the land had been cleaned.
Yoko Sudo's land was in one of the worst affected areas. Furious that after an earthquake and tsunami, it was a man-made disaster that had caused some of the worst devastation, she was determined to deal with it as naturally as possible.
I had read reports that said that sunflowers and canola absorb radioactivity, so I chose to plant them. But a hectare is a large area. I would have preferred to get rid of the entire top layer of soil, but I am on my own, so I couldn't do this. So I did what I could by sowing sunflower and canola seed. I harvested these plants and then took them to a specific place. Now, around Fukushima, they have set up what they call cleaning centers, where you take your contaminated produce to be disposed of. They burn them, and they are transformed into ash, radioactive ash, which has to be disposed of in a certain way, as it obviously can't be released into the atmosphere. But these cleaning centers are now full.
Both Yoko Sudo and Ishida Masayoshi are worried about how the authorities intend to dispose of this waste. They say no adequate solution has yet been found. Yoko's also skeptical about government advice to farmers to reduce crop contamination by spreading their fields with zeolite, a mineral which absorbs radioactivity.
They say we should use zeolite. But I don't agree with this, so I'm not doing it. Zeolite is a mineral which absorbs radiation, but then it will be reabsorbed by my land, so I don't see the point of farmers using it. It doesn't make sense to me.
Instead, Yoko Sudo has chosen a route she feels is safer and, once again, more natural.
Now I've given back the more contaminated field to the owner and rented a less contaminated one of 2 hectares. I've sown soya there and am producing soya oil because soya doesn't absorb cesium and potassium, so my oil is very safe. I'm making a product I can market.
Yoko will soon be harvesting her soya crop and then plans to sow wheat, which is equally resistant to radioactive substances. Although it offers her a business solution, she hasn't found peace of mind.
You can't yet declare things 100% safe because every family's land is different. Some are sand-based, some are clay-based, so some retain more water than others. Those that have water which stagnates are very contaminated, but where the water drains normally, it's much less at risk. My field is safe now, but investigations have this problem. So, for example, the farm next to mine has this problem, which makes my situation complicated too.
The situation's even worse in the mountains above Fukushima, where citrus fruits, mushrooms, bamboo, and many native Japanese mountain fruits are all still contaminated. For now, families rely on Geiger counters at home and can take foods to centres equipped with sophisticated machinery to measure radioactivity. Yoko would have liked to see more community collaboration among farmers. She also says she understands many parents' concern about feeding local produce to their children.
Some farmers work together with the scientists and researchers, but some won't. But now, you can't even sell a small quantity without tests. Even for your own consumption, you have to get your crops analysed. It's mandatory. After the crops have been analysed and declared safe, we eat them. We hope they are safe for us.
Yoko Sudo says fighting the invisible enemy is complex and painful. Uncertain if and when she'll ever be able to return to her organic farming ideal, she nevertheless refuses to give up hope.
I touch my land and I love my land. That's why I do this job with so much passion.
Thank you to Danny Mitzman for that report. And that brings us to the end of this special edition of Living Planet, celebrating a few of the women who are helping to keep the planet green. We've been playing music from Lady Gaga as well as Kenya's Susanna Uwiyo, both artists vocal on gender and environmental issues. I'm Saroja Coelho. I'll be back again next week with news and stories about the environment. You can also find us anytime on dw.de/environment. From everyone here in studio, happy International Women's Day. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're broke or evergreen, your black, white, beige, Chola descent, your Lebanese, your Orient. Whether life's disabilities left you outcast, but leader teased, rejoice and love yourself today, cause baby, you were born this way.
No matter gay, straight or bi, lesbian, transgender life, I'm on